This is the Baymaw Podcast with Marty Solomon. I'm his co-host, Brent Billings. Today I'm with Reed Dent and L. Grover Fricks to discuss the words of Psalm 137.
I prefer to think of it more as discussing the feelings of Psalm 137.
You had your chance to shape my introduction and you're like, oh, just whatever.
This is a little fly by the seat of our pants, so that's good. Keeping everybody on their toes.
I don't know what you're talking about. I am incredibly prepared. As always.
L might sound a little different. L has new audio equipment.
Ooh.
What is new? The in-ears? The monitors?
Well, she does have new in-ear monitors.
That doesn't make her sound different.
No, but she does have a new preamp on her mic.
Oh, the preamp. Yeah, totally.
A new compressor and all sorts of other things.
Just the details our listeners came for.
You know, I was wondering what sounded different about her voice, and then I realized, oh, it's the preamp. You're right.
Yeah, I don't know if you probably can't tell anything over Zoom, but when you listen back to the final produced episode, you may be able to detect a difference. Listeners with keen ears, if you detect a difference, there it is.
Yep.
You're not making it up.
That's good to know.
Just putting an end to gaslighting everywhere. That's Brent's role.
Just in time for this psalm. For 137. Okay, well, I think what we'll do is we'll just go ahead and let's read the psalm, Brent. Can you just read it all the way through? And then we'll kind of go back through it in chunks like we've done with our other psalms.
And what translation are we reading today, Reed?
Ah, well, this translation is entirely a product of the very talented L. It's all hers. It says, do you have a name for your translation that you're putting together?
Nope.
Oh, well, you should get one.
The translation of L. Grover Fricks.
EGF? Like, should we just call
the
it?
EGF.
We'll call it the EGF.
EGFV?
EGFV. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's good. That's what we're calling it. The EGFV, the L. Grover Fricks version. So let's hit it.
Over the sparkling rivers poured together, there we sat and also wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the braided willow branches, in the midst of her, as hanged men, our lyres swung. For there our captors asked us for the words of a song, and those who gloat over us for joy. Sing for us a song of Zion. How will we sing the song of Yahweh? If I forget you, Yerushalayim, you will forget my right hand. Like Adam to Chava, my tongue will cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not raise Yerushalayim over the head of my joy. For the sons of red dirt, remember, Yahweh. Remember the day of Yerushalayim. They are saying, strip them bare to her foundation. Daughter of mixed waters who is being bound by demons, happy is the one who will pay you for the deeds you have done to us. Happy is the one who will grasp and scatter your unborn toward the towering crags.
That's okay. So there are some interesting translation choices that we'll talk about as we go through. Interesting, I mean that genuinely, not like suspect.
Interesting.
Who would I be to question you? Of course not. No, but I think there are some interesting choices that I would like to hear on. But first, let's just get a reaction here. This is a strong psalm, mm-hmm. strong emotions, I think this fits pretty squarely into disorientation. The people, mm-hmm. the community has been disoriented, by a calamity, but just y'all's reactions to this psalm off the bat.
Yeah, it's like a psalm that creates space for the immediate reaction or the immediate the wake of trauma, the wake of abuse, the wake of injustice, and it creates room for people who are experiencing that. That's not immediate reorientation, right? We have a whole psalm here, which, by the way, in the Jewish community, you say after every meal or after every dinner during the weekday. So frequent community opportunity to reflect on this, not kind of shoved away into the shadows behind the bookcase, right? It doesn't end with like, you know, glory be to God, all things work together for good. It certainly has a like, there is better coming, around the corner, right? It's not just like chaos and despair, but I do like that the Jewish community has made that a regular part of their rhythms.
That's interesting.
Leaving room for people. Yeah.
That's interesting because in my Christian community growing up, I don't recall this ever being a subject of discussion. This particular psalm, I remember lots of other psalms making their way into our worship and our prayer, but not this one. And there may be, I'm sure there are reasons for that we might get into, but yes, agree and resonate with all of that. Brent, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, some pretty crazy imagery. Upon the braided willow branches in the midst of her, as hanged men our lyres swung.
Like, I just want to say, by the way, that's maybe my favorite thing that I've read that you have translated or heard, because I do sometimes listen to The Text in Us. Shout out to that podcast. But that line, as hanged men our lyres swung, I think is like just an incredible translation, L, on lots of levels.
Chef's kiss. Thank you. Thank you. It's in there. I do, like I said last time, I think I did give myself a little bit more wiggle room when it's poetry to spend time bringing out the imagery that's in the text. Mm-hmm. But it's there.
Yeah.
I'm also intrigued by the way you have indented and tabbed various portions of this. I'm assuming there's a reason behind all of these ways of formatting.
Less inherent in the Hebrew, right, because they do have punctuation, but it was added by the Masoretes much later. That is a piece that the Text in Us doesn't get to share with folks, is the way that I space things out. But coming to theaters near you, not actually theaters, but we do have Genesis coming out, Lord willing, this year, so we'll see. Mm-hmm. And then people can read along that way. Not this psalm. Staying in the vaults.
I was also wondering on the line, like Adam to Chava, my tongue will cling to the roof of my mouth.
Ugh, so good.
And we were talking about the different types of T's and the difference between the dentalized T and the palatized T. Mm-hmm. Is that in play in the Hebrew? Is there...
With like Adam and Chava's name?
Well, just the idea of tongue clinging to the roof of my mouth.
Ooh,
like...
No, I think that's after Adam and Chava's wedding scene, right? It says that they cling to one another, which we use in our wedding rites today, right? Let no man put asunder what God has joined together. And so I presume we'll get to that part later, but I think it has to do with, it's a thing of love. It's a thing of sacredness, a guarding of something good that the psalmist is refusing to entertain babble here. Mm. But now we're ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, let's go back to this first section here. Brent, actually, I'm wondering, can we go back and reread those first few verses there at the top of the page?
Over the sparkling rivers poured together, there we sat and also wept when we remembered Zion. Sion. Is that right?
Power on through. Yes, it is Sion.
Upon the braided willow branches in the midst of her, as hanged men our lyres swung. For there our captors asked us for the words of a song, and those who gloat over us for joy. Sing for us a song of Sion. How will we sing the song of Yahweh?
Yeah, so...
Is that last line meant to be a question? Like, how are we going to do this in the midst of all of this stuff going on? Or is it like a...
I believe that's it. I don't think they're asking about like how do I sing? Tell me, how do I do a scale? Do
well,
I mean?
Yeah, not like a mechanical like how do we do it literally, but like how are we going to do this in the midst of what's going on versus how, maybe more like how we will sing because of what's going on.
It's not mechanically how are we going to sing, but how are we going to find it within ourselves to be able to sing? Yeah. Like, how could we possibly do this?
How are we going to muster the will to do this in light of what's going on? Or is it how we will do it anyway because of what's going on around us?
To me, those are the same thing.
Okay.
Okay. I'm sorry. Who can know the mind of Brent, its depths and its heights? Romans.
So
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So
more helpful.
No. So on this first part, then clearly, like, so I think the L, what you have translated as over the sparkling rivers poured together, mm-hmm. is commonly translated as
over the waters of Babylon.
Right.
So, I mean, the word there is Babel, which has three meanings. You can just go with the transliterated version. Babel, right, mm-hmm. which is not, doesn't have a lot of information in it, except for a geographic location. But the underlying picture behind the Babel, or etymologically its meaning, is it's these rivers that are coming together, which if you know anything about Babylon, that makes sense mm-hmm. because their irrigation system is the, you know, their height of glory. The lower class people live closer toward the waters that were, you know, coming together. And then the higher class you were, the further up the hill you got to live from the water. So it's a very defining part of life in Babylon. But also, of course, Genesis, right? Babel, the Tower of Babel, that waters coming together is one of the words for confusion, which I think is another frequent motif in the experience of people who have experienced tragedy, trauma, abuse, etc., is over the sparkling confusion, right? It keeps catching your eye. It keeps blinding you out of your periphery. It's just being confused. How did this happen? Why did this happen? What am I supposed to do? This wasn't going to be my story.
For sure.
So I think all those things are great to bring out.
Yeah, I mean, it works on all of those levels in this psalm, I think, where as a community, this is a communal psalm with the we there. We sat there and we wept. And, you know, in reference to Babylon and the captivity, the exile, having now left and we're in a strange land, we've been deported off somewhere else. So it's Babylon makes clear sense. And a lot of translators do it that way, by the waters of Babylon.
Right.
But I like the idea that it also encapsulates the confusion that is felt. And that's, I think, wrapped up in this question of, how are we going to sing the songs? How are we going to worship? Even singing the song of Yahweh, how it's phrased there, of Adonai, that reminds me of the song of Moses. I will sing a song to Yahweh. And this is almost like the inverted sort of situation where instead of having overcome the enemies, and now we are singing a song. We have been overcome by our enemies. And how are we going to do this? This isn't something we can do like in a strange place.
Right.
And so clearly this is set amongst, tragedy. Calamity is the word that I kind of kept coming back to. Like the world as we know it was turned on its head. Everything's falling apart. And so the first thing we can do is we can sit down and weep together. Mm-hmm. Which I liked how you pointed out from the very get-go, this is creating space for that without, mm-hmm. like, we're not going to be rushed through that weeping in the course of this psalm. This is one that doesn't really end with, we're doing an episode on Psalm 13.
Nice.
Or we did already, Brent?
Yeah, that one already is out. With Josh.
Yeah. So and that is like famously the how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever?
Right.
But it ends still with that turn of, but I have trusted, you know, and this one doesn't really get there. It's like at the end of it, it ends with, you know, we'll get to the ending about throwing babies.
It does for me. To me, that's enough.
Yes, and I want that's a good point that I want to get to, right? But we're not, it's like what is enough is just being able to like be in that anguish, express that anguish.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get expressly transformed into something else.
Right. And it's a communal thing too,
yes.
Right? In our culture, especially for some of us, mm-hmm. Weeping is even like a bad word.
Right.
You know, expressing grief is something you should do by yourself in your room. And then you like need to pull it together when you come out for the funeral. You know, you're allowed to maybe have a single tear at the funeral, but not like communal bawling.
It's like, well, you're kind of making everybody uncomfortable with your ugly crying.
If you could not, that'd be great.
I want to talk for a second about, so in the midst of the weeping, the loss, the confusion, and the grief, I am personally moved by "We wept when we remembered Zion."
Yeah.
And I'm intrigued. So we, our family, my family, in late December, my wife's grandmother passed away on Christmas Eve, and she was just a very, very special person in the family. The loss is like being keenly felt. And Leanne and I and our boys have been talking about like the value of memory and remembering. And so I'm just curious if either of you, this is kind of a general question, but have any thoughts about the role of remembering in the wake of grief and loss? What is the purpose, or not the purpose, what is like the benefit or even the necessity of we're going to remember together as we are going through this very difficult time?
Yeah, I think we see a couple different models around memory and Tanakh, in that sometimes God is like, get a bunch of rocks, drag them over, make this a new part of the landscape that every time you and your children and your children's children cross the Yarden, cross the river, or whatever, it is a new feature in the land, in the environment, that causes you to retell the story. So we have that model. On the kind of other end of the spectrum, we have David's model, which seems to be kind of a positive framing by the text, that he loses a child, and it says that he mourns for 3 days, and then he gets up and resumes his duties and kind of goes on. He doesn't like paint a mural about it. He just carries on. And then in the middle, there's two different words for forgetting. And they come up in the story of Yosef, which is another story of drama and tragedy and familial brokenness, right? And slavery and deportation. And it says that he was forgetting. And there's two kinds of forgetting. There's the forgetting where you intentionally, like, you have forgotten the covenant of the Lord your God and you broke it. And then there's the kind of forgetting where you just left your keys on the counter, and you can't find them because you're looking in all the other places except for right exactly where they are.
Which, by the way, we also talked about that in our episode on Psalm that "Will You Forget Me Forever?"
Oh, nice.
And I was referring to you in that episode because you and I had talked, you know, just on the side about those two different words.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think both of those things can happen, right? Maybe the King David with his son, that's a more of an intentional, okay, I'm breaking this, I'm choosing to carry on. But there can also be another kind of forgetting, right? That's can be healing of, you know, I've processed this, I've gone through it, I've woven it into the story of my life, but it's not the center of who I am. The center of who I am is in a different identity, and my future is more important than my past. And so it kind of just gets left by the wayside of like, oh yeah, that is a part of my story. And that can be a beautiful thing too. That's good healing as well. So I think there's lots of room for different roles for memory after calamity. What is the thing you want to hold on to? Is it the faithfulness of God? Is it, you know, those people and what they did to me, right? So it's like, what part of memory are you talking about?
So here, what's being remembered is what was lost. And I wonder, Elle, do you think that sometimes we're squeamish about bringing up, like if we're in the midst of people who have lost something or someone, are we squeamish about bringing it up because, like, we don't want to make the pain worse or something? Like, we're afraid to remember it out loud.
Right.
Like, with Leanne's grandpa, there can be, like, this, well, should we talk about Mima? Like, should we say her name? Should we not? Like, is that going to make it harder for you?
Yeah, there's uncertainty, but there's also vulnerability, right? The canned phrase that you say when you find out someone has experienced loss is, oh, I'm sorry about your loss. But it's not, oh man, how are you? I mean, if you know someone well, it's how are you doing? Mm-hmm. But we don't usually dive into what did you really love about that person? Mm-hmm. It can also be because lots of time loss isn't clean cut. Like, to me, there's something beautiful about somebody who lived a long and excellent life with integrity and faithfulness, and they make it to the end, and we get together and echo the Father, you know, saying this person was an incredible servant. That's beautiful, but that's not everyone's story of loss, right? And so,
right, yeah,
knowing what kind of like box are you opening by talking to someone about their loss, feelings of guilt, feelings of shame, like didn't reconcile at the end, feelings of like joy if it was an unsavory person, right? All of that is in there. And so asking about it, I think, should be earned, probably.
I think that's a really good point to bring up. There are some losses that are like a peaceful parting of the ways, and then there are some losses that are like a tragic ripping apart.
Right.
Which I think is more what's going on here in this psalm. Like, we were yanked out of our home, and we were gloated over, you know, we were taunted. There is this like injury, or there's this insult to the injury here.
Right.
But knowing the circumstances, and, you know, in depending on the company, on your relationship to the company, it may be there may be times where it is appropriate to like, let's remember together what we have lost.
Right.
I mean, there is, I think, comfort in sometimes remembering, even though it's gone, there can be comfort in remembering it.
Yeah.
Maybe even a fear that we're going to forget if we don't speak about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But remembering together, I think, there is a sort of, you're lamenting, and there is also something comforting in it at the same time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, Ebenezer, the words that we use for memorial, Even means stone, Etzer means help, right? Mm. So it's a stone of help. It's helping you remember, like, it seems like they're sad. I agree, focusing on remembering Sion, but I think there is probably something comforting in that too. Like, do you remember how the sunlight used to hit the hill across from our village every morning? And the quality of light was like pink and gold, and you could hear the, you know, the bugs start to wake up and the oxen start to call out, you know, all that kind of thing could also be part of this. And that can be an Even Etzer, a way to help you, like, this reality is not the only reality. And somewhere thousands of miles away, the pink and gold sunrise is still hitting that hill with just that quality of light. I think that can be nice.
That's just a beautiful picture on its own, even without having experienced that. Like, those words painted something in my mind. And how much more vivid is that going to be for somebody who's actually experienced it and is actually remembering those things happening?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that. So moving on to the last part of this stanza then, about singing, how will we sing the song of Yahweh upon strange dirt? I was reading Eugene Peterson on this, and he talks about like the silence that the psalmists in the community are taking on. They are going to be silent. He talks about it as like a dignifying thing. Like, their only sort of dignity here is it's almost like a refusal. We're not going to, and you get the captors who are gloating over them, sing for us. So I'm just curious, like, do you think that there is something to that idea about, like, we're going to maintain our dignity by refusing to do what you are saying? Or do you think that this is just an expression of, like, the depth of the sort of confusion and mourning? Like, we don't even know how we could do this. How do you guys hear that? What do you think about what he's saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking from the lens of abuse, which, of course, is not the only lens with which one can approach this text, the most people of all realms of abuse usually know their abuser. And there's this common theme in many people's stories of the abusive person wanting the victim of the crime to walk them through it. Like, of being insecure afterward. This can be a parent, right? Like, oh, I did a good job, honey, right? You know, and you're like, actually, no. Or
oh, sure. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And that can show up in lots of different ways. Like, that was good for you, right? All of those things is a theme. And the refusal to say that, to be like, I will be your therapist through this moment. I will include you, the agent of injustice, the agent of evil in my remembering. No, you don't get to experience my inner world. No, you don't get to enjoy the beauty of thinking about that hillside. Absolutely not. If you want to work through your sin, you're invited to do that. But that's not the victim's job to help you with, right? To be like, oh yeah, was that like a really pretty land? Oh, wow. I guess that's a bummer. I mean, the emperor told me to, right? The emperor told me to take you away. It wasn't me. Like, if it was up to me, I wouldn't have done it. You know, that kind of conversation I can imagine happening. Like, oh, I honor your culture. Tell me about that. No, I'm good. You don't get to experience that with me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's interesting. I think, you know, the first part of that, for there our captors ask us for the words of a song, sounds a little bit more like what you're just saying right there.
Yeah.
Like, oh, tell us about, you know, where you came from. And it's like, no, we're not going to do that. And then the next one, though, feels more, I mean, it's definitely more like antagonistic or arrogant.
Yeah.
They gloat over us for joy, sing for us a song, you know. And
yeah.
I think it's interesting to see kind of both of those, I guess, mentalities of the captors potentially represented there.
Yeah.
And to think of the response as just how will we do this, which is kind of like saying no. It's almost like this psalm is a little bit anti-psalm, you know? Like a lot of the psalms are about singing for joy about the victory, you know? And even like talking about there we sat down by the waters. Eugene points this out. It's like instead of here, it's there. Mm-hmm. And we're not singing. We are remaining silent. And it's an anti-psalm, but it's doing the job still of, you know, in some way it is dignifying or giving comfort to the community that is writing it. That's going through the grieving process.
A spiritual meditation on loss and refusing to parade that loss in front of others. And I like in the next portion, right, we have, if I forget you, Yerushalayim, you will forget my right hand, right? That's not, like, the reason I'm not telling you about it isn't that I don't remember, but rather, like, Adam Chava, my tongue will cling to the roof of my mouth. It is because of love, just because of the sacredness of what I'm not talking about, that I'm not telling you about it. It's not your gift. You already ripped me away from my gift, and I'm not going to share the gift with you.
I wonder if you. So I'm interested in what you're saying about the Adam Techava. My tongue will cling to the roof of my mouth. Can you say a little bit more about that, El? Like what's behind that you're getting at about it being we're not going to speak of a sacred thing.
Yeah. So the root there is the word davak. Davak shows up in Genesis 2. I think we mentioned it at the top of the episode. That it's when it says that they join together, that it is good that a man shall leave his father's household and will davak to his woman. And so it's a very visceral image, right? It's not just like I'm tied to you or we're holding hands. It's like getting honey off your fingers. It's stuck to you. And of course, the context of that, not very frequently used verb, is one of sacredness. It's a context of love. It's a context of holiness that should not be breached by an outer party, right? That's what Babylon has done, is breached into what is sacred to them and hauled them away. Were you thinking of going a different direction? And so that's why it's...
No. I mean, so I was hearing it originally as, so the first part, if I forget you, Jerusalem, you will forget my right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, I'm curious just how you guys hear that. It sounds like, far be it from me to forget Jerusalem, right? You will forget my right hand. I mean, I thought about specifically the connection between the hand and the playing of the lyre, which is a part of like, we hung up our lyres. And then,
right.
I guess I was here. So the next part, like, my tongue will cling to the roof of my mouth. I was hearing that more as, like, I guess kind of a negative connotation, like in the same way that my hand would be forgotten, that my mouth would, like, cease to function, you know, like I'm not going to sing. I won't be able to sing. I won't be able to play if I forget where I came from. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that. It's like an extension of the self curse there, the curse of
right.
May my right hand wither is what some people, the RSV, I think, goes with that.
But the thing you're saying about that word cling, I think that's, yeah, I think there's something that to that.
I think it's relating back to this conversation they're having with their captor of like dance monkey.
Yeah, yeah, yes,
no,
yes.
No. We're not doing that. I'm not going to pretend that this didn't happen to me.
That's good.
Right. I'm not willing to erase it to make you more comfortable with your sin.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I don't know. There's a question I have. Question maybe. Is there something to say about the Psalm's emphasis on Zion and Jerusalem? And like, there's the mention of how will we sing the song of Yahweh? But other than that, like, God is not really the kind of the object of like loss or remembrance here. It's Zion and Jerusalem. Do you have any like response to that?
I do. I think it's incredibly insightful theophany about why is there suffering, right? I think there is a time and a place to turn questions surrounding tragedy to God and be like, hey, tell me about this because it doesn't make any sense to me with your character. But these people seem to have a very strong posture that the perpetrator here is not God. It's the person who's perpetrated the injustice, right? So why is there suffering in the world? Well, because we have agency, and what we have chosen to do is create suffering. And of course, there's also the possibility of the posture of saying, like, how did we bring this upon ourselves, right? The role of the prophets is often that, to say, hey, how did we position ourselves that this happened so that we might not do it again? So there's room for all three of those conversations. But I think that it can be healing and helpful to be like, is it God that did this to you? Or was it, you know, that person in your church that did this to you? And God was present in that situation, but did God cause that conversation? That needs to be, you know, part of the processing of everyone who has experienced tragedy, and should be done in their own time. But it's really lovely that Tanakh gives us all these different voices to come out with tragedy, right? If you're feeling like, oh, no, it's this evil pastor who did blah, 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 or, oh, no, it's God. He said he had a plan for my life. Or saying, oh, how is it that I agreed to, you know, go to that church for so many years, whatever it was. There's room for all of those moments in Tanakh, and I think that's the case for a reason.
Yeah. What you're saying about how it's like, well, this evil has happened because these evil people did this thing to us.
Right.
That is that we'll get into that like at the end of the psalm when we get into the kind of uncomfy bits about killing babies.
Sure.
But there is a function in like in an outcry of even hatred. That is, at least you are able to identify where the evil is. Like, let's not worry about, like, whether or not, like, what our response to the evil should be, like, in terms of should we, like, find compassion or mercy, or, like, we're not there yet. The first thing we need to do is identify where is the root of this, and it's, look at these people did to us, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's, yeah, that's good. Okay, well, let's move on to that second instance there, and let's go into the
third section here.
Yeah, can you read that next verse for us there, Brent?
For the sons of red dirt, remember Yahweh, remember the day of Yerushalayim. They are saying, strip them bare to her foundation.
Sons of red dirt, let's talk about that for a second, Al.
Okay.
What's the translation choice there?
So you can go a lot of directions. You could do Son of Adam, Narnia style. We love some C.S. Lewis in this house. Mm-hmm. This house is actually Brent's house, so I don't know. Maybe you hate C.S. Lewis.
Oh, no, I love it.
Great.
Didn't name my son after him, but
I mean, not everybody's as cool as Reed and I, so so that's one take. Another take is son of Ad. So son of Adam is a name. Then you have son of Adam, which is often translated humanity, because Adam goes through this transformation where he has the definite article at the front. I've talked about this in other places. So it's really the Adam. So it's the person. And then later he becomes Ish, a man. So you could do sons of humanity, but the picture behind that word for person or humanity is the picture of dirt, because of course that's how Adam was made, from the dirt. And it's also the word for red, which, if you're in that region, makes sense. It looks a lot more like Utah in spaces than it does the Pacific Northwest, or rather the inland Northwest, where I am currently. So sons of red dirt has to do with our humanity, where we came from, where we're going, all of the above.
What about Edomites?
Yeah.
This is the way that Alter renders it, as the Edomites.
Ooh, fascinating. Edomites is usually Edomiti. We have this, little suffix that we put on when we're talking about people from a specific place.
Okay.
That is probably more standard because we're used to reading stuff where there, you know, there's imprecations. There's people yelling at, you know, the Canaanites or whoever.
Sure.
But here it doesn't say that. It doesn't say Edomiti. It just says Edom.
Yeah, I mean, thematically, if it is or if it were to be talking about Edom, I think it still kind of tracks along with, you know, as the Israelites are being taken off, they're being overthrown by Babylon, and there's like the betrayal from the Edomites, who were kind of like, they're that way, like assisting.
Sure.
And so it's like the pain of upon pain, and they're saying, strip them bare to her foundation. And it's like, we're just sort of, I was hearing that as we're now going even, we're going to go all the way into it, you know, like we're going as deep into the, like, not just like the being overcome by an enemy, but potentially being betrayed by our kin, you know,
which is great and resonates for lots of people, like bystanders. You were there. You saw what so-and-so did and said.
Exactly.
So I love how that tracks across time, space. But I also love, if it is talking about humanity, for the sons of humanity, remember us, right? For our sake, which is really nice, because so often it's like, for your name's sake, God. It's like, no, it's me. Please remember me and remember how these people were speaking about me, right?
Absolutely. Okay, so let's go to the last maybe most infamous part of this psalm, and let's talk about let's talk about enemies and let's talk about hate.
Daughter of mixed waters, who is being bound by demons, happy is the one who will pay you for the deeds you have done to us. Happy is the one who will grasp and scatter your unborn toward the towering crags.
Okay, so we've talked about daughter of mixed waters, where we can leave that as it was. I'm curious about your next line here. Who is being bound by demons?
Yeah, that kind of raises your alert a little, huh? That's funny. Weird, Reed. Where does that stand out to you? So yeah, that's Hashduda, which is kind of fun to say. There's kind of two ways you can take that word. That's a big problem for us across text, actually, is identifying exactly what's happening with this root. Like when the names for God has the same Shaddad root in it. So one of those roots means demon. So and it has to do with binding specifically. We don't think that God, of course, one of his titles has to do with demons. So it's probably not in that case, but it could be here. Another way you can translate it, because binding and withering are a similar construct in Hebrew, you could also translate it daughter of mixed waters whose breasts are withering, which certainly would parallel nicely with a discussion around the unborn in the next lines, right?
Yeah, they would.
So either way, but we do have other imagery when we're talking about places that aren't Israeli in the ancient Near East. we do have other spots where things seem like there's allusions to demons, specifically in Genesis when it's talking about Avraham and where he came from. That's where a lot of our midrash about Avraham comes from, those connections that they make there. So I don't know. I'm not tied to either one.
Okay.
But I do like something that makes an eyebrow raise. That's great.
I mean, that was one of those at the beginning when I was like, there's some interesting translation choices. I would like to know about this, especially because I also see your footnote there that says, or whose breasts are withering.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, well, which is it? Okay. So then we get into that. One of the things that's curious to me here is how we move into like beatitude kind of language. Happy is the one who will pay you, repay you for the deeds you've done to us. Happy the one who will grasp and scatter your unborn toward the scattering towering crags.
Yep.
It seems kind of morbid and backwards to say it like a beatitude, like other psalms where we get this language, like in Psalms 1 and 2, where it's like, happy is the one who meditates on your law day and night. And now we get, happy is the one who will repay you for what you have done to us.
Yeah.
I think it's really easy for us to jump straight to like a moral judgment about this, to kind of moralize, right? Especially for those of us who have not maybe experienced the kind of calamity, or the word that Brueggemann uses that we'll get to in a second is brutalization. Mm-hmm. We haven't been brutalized in the way that these people have been. And so we need to hang up our moral judgment hat for a second.
Yeah.
And actually, Brent, I want to ask you, what is your like reaction just to that language there, especially the one at the end, happy the one who will grasp and scatter your unborn, which, by the way, L, you have unborn.
Mm-hmm.
Why unborn instead of infant?
That's a great question. Let me scroll right on back to the proper psalm in the Hebrew.
I didn't mean to catch you off guard.
That's fine. The reason I went with unborn there is it's not the usual word for baby. Tinuk is our usual word for baby, and here it's olel. And it's like the smallest word. It's been a long time since I translated this. Sorry, I have to go back and check on why I did stuff.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Oh, okay. The reason I went with it there, it doesn't have to be unborn. It isn't the usual word for baby or infant. It's more unusual, but it does seem to refer to the unborn in other places. So like Job 3:16.
Oh, I see.
It seems to be talking very specifically about the unborn, but there's still room. There's things that are unknown, like why are there so many different words for babies? Hard to say. So it could be babies. It could be unborn. I went with that because of Job, but
either way, we're talking about tiny, helpless humans.
Yes, very much so.
Okay. So Brent, tell me, like, what's your reaction to that beatitude? Happy the one who will grasp and scatter your unborn. Like, what's your initial response to that?
Well, and is the implication based on the call for Yahweh to remember, like, that God is the one carrying out this repayment for deeds and this grasping and scattering, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how we're supposed to
could
read
be
it?
The implication doesn't have to be.
Because if that, like, that's my assumption. And so reading that, it's like, what? how could God be happy to do this? Like, even if it was somehow considered to be deserved, like, how could God take pleasure in that?
Okay.
So it's really, yeah, it's very uncomfortable.
Mm. El, what about you? What's your response to this?
I love it.
Say more.
I mean, obviously, getting into the specifics of it, it's vile.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for those of us who have lots of privilege and haven't had, you know, what we call in the therapeutic community, adverse childhood events or adverse life events, right? It's like, what are you talking about? How can you possibly put those pieces together? No shots fired there, Brent.
So what would you say to those people?
Right. Right. Well, I'm getting there.
Oh,
I take no offense. Please.
Good, good, good.
Please share
freely. Forever when he doesn't, I'm so glad. Like, it shouldn't be a shame on you thing. It's a, oh, no, that totally makes sense that you wouldn't get it. And that's a wonderful, beautiful thing. But there is something to the fact that if you have experienced a severe injustice, and especially if it's recent and it hasn't been decades, right? That it doesn't feel like justice. It doesn't feel like heaven if there's not actual retribution, right? This all makes me think of the Exodus story where, you know, they have all these chances over and over and over, Egypt, Mitzrayim, to fess up for what they did to the children of the Israelites, and they didn't, 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 right? And God was going to just have the people go and have their new start be justice. But because they kept doubling down and doubling down and doubling down, the plague of the firstborn happened, right? And God sees everything that is done to us, and it does have a weight and it does have a cost. And when we talk about forgiveness and having to lift those things up, is really heavy things for some of us, right? It's not just like, oh, my sibling said this and it hurt my feelings, right? It's like deep wounds that we're asked to shoulder and give over to God, right? And so, like, for those with power and for those with privilege, being like, can't you just like get into peace? And like, that's not God's character. God's good all the time. And like, happiness is having forgiveness and letting go. Well, it's easy to say when, you know, you're on the side of the oppressor, the perpetrator, that your ancestors were the ones who did XYZ. Of course, you're going to say that peace is the best thing. But if you are a person who has been separated from your child, you aren't just, you know, it's not as simple as like, okay, I'll just find forgiveness. I'll just find peace. And, you know, the butterflies will flutter around. It's, there is a viscerality to give me your kid. Let me let you know how it feels to be me, right? And we don't have that ability to like Spock.
Right.
It's not just Spock, but in a Star Trek, you know, putting the hand on someone else's head and being like, feel what I'm feeling. So doing the same thing to someone else, I don't think is a holy urge, a holy instinct, and one that it's good to remain in for the rest of your days. I'm not like giving that as good ministry advice of like, yes, wish hellfire upon your enemies. But it is natural. It is, I think, a part of the process of like, I want you to experience something of what you've done to me, because clearly you don't get it, because you're asking me to sing for joy.
Yeah.
To be like, I'm just glad to be at the table, you know, like, thank you.
I saw a video recently of some from Ukraine, and without getting into like any of the politics of that situation, just the actual like devastation of it.
Right.
There was a video of these people riding in their car. They had come back to their home city for the first time since it had been like put under attack. And the city is just gone. Like, it's just decimated, leveled everywhere. And these people in the video are like, they're wailing, they're sobbing, and they're cursing. They're like not like saying cuss words. They're like cursing the Russians who did this to them. And like wanting to, it's exactly what you just said, like visiting back upon them the same thing that had just happened to the to the Ukrainians. And it made me think, you know, there are just times where it's kind of nonsense to try to speak of whether somebody ought or ought not to hate. You know, there's no should or shouldn't here. That question is really irrelevant at the time of your tragedy. And it just is.
And the request for otherwise is so often for our own comfort, right? We don't like vulnerability. We don't like hearing about anybody else's pain. So going with like, haven't you found God to be sufficient for you through that? Like, shouldn't you just like let it go? Yes. But it's not helpful.
Brueggemann asked this question in his commentary on this. He said, can forgiveness be a mode of coming to terms too easily?
Hmm.
Could it be that genuine forgiveness is possible only when there has been a genuine articulation of hatred? That's a good question, right? I mean, I think I heard a sermon one time on forgiveness where they were talking about, Miroslav Volf points out that the first step in forgiveness is actually accusation. It's pointing the finger. Like when Jesus in Matthew 18 is telling you how to deal with when somebody has wronged you, he says, go and tell them their fault. Like, you've got to go and say it out loud, you know? And in this case, like, we're not just talking about like there, depending on the level of tragedy or calamity that's been experienced, like, we move on a scale from like, hey, it really hurt me when you did this, but like, when what you did was like completely destroy my hometown.
Yeah.
Like, we're like way many levels above that. Right.
Right.
But the thing is, like, some of us, those of us who are in those positions of privilege and comfort, and maybe who have even been on the side of the oppressors, I don't know, maybe we're just too nice to be like, to understand forgiveness, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that there is a place for, we've got to be able to say and pray. I think this is what I appreciate about the Psalms. And we said this before, but I'll say it again. Like, you've got to be able to pray what you really are and who you really are, not what you ought to be. You know, like, we can dispense with the decorum and what's appropriate. We just need to be able to say what we need to say.
Yeah. And all jumping too quickly to well, shouldn't, you know, we be able to let go and et cetera, diminishes the incredible partnership with the Holy Spirit that people who do engage in radical forgiveness mm-hmm. are expressing, right? Like, I'm thinking of Rwanda and the incredible work there of the victims of genocide, forgiving and adopting and partnering with the people who murdered their family members. Marty told us that story, I don't know, 15 years ago, told me that story 15 years ago. And it stuck with me. And was helpful for me in my journey, life-changing for me on my journey, that it wasn't like, oh, as a Christian, like, I should blah, 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 and I ought to, et cetera, get over it because, like, loving your enemies is a Christian thing to do. It was, there is beautiful work happening in the world of people who've experienced the most raw brutalization, like Ewan Brickman said. And yet they're able to tap into some strength of God, some strength of spirit that enables them to stand in the wake of that tragedy in the cemetery, in the yard where their kid was killed in a genocide, and to look at the perpetrator and say, would you like to be my son? Like, that is insanely glorious, insanely beautiful. All those years later after hearing that still gives, you know, me goosebumps. And deciding to forgive someone in that way is partnering in that incredible resurrection work that God's doing in the world. And when we expect that, right, and just tell people to do that without giving space for this, for the boy, is God going to be gleeful when he does to you what you did to me? Robs that Holy Spirit work of its beauty and its glory and its majesty and its heaviness, right? All of those words.
Your phrase, insanely glorious. I do think that there is something insanely glorious and beautiful about that. There is something that is like, and I think it's a really good observation to see the potential for the partnership with the Spirit. There is something that is like just so very actually like alive and present, you know, and not burying your head in the sand, but like the raw sort of like the wires are exposed and you can sort of see the voltage like pumping through. Yeah. So I want to read a paragraph, that kind of gets to that. This is from, Eugene Peterson's book, Answering God. He has this great chapter called Enemies, where he deals with this psalm. And this is what he says. He says, our hate needs to be prayed, not suppressed. Hate is our emotional link with the spirituality of evil. It is the volcanic eruption of outrage when the holiness of being, ours and another's, has been violated. So he's saying this is like a, this is, it, hate is the right response to an encounter with real evil. This is what should be going on. And then he also goes on to say, it is also the ugliest and most dangerous of our emotions, the hair trigger on a loaded gun. Embarrassed by the ugliness and fearful of the murderous, we commonly neither admit nor pray our hate. We deny it and suppress it. So he's just acknowledging there kind of what we said, like, oh, this makes me uncomfy. Like, can we not? And also, you might really end up like, you know, you're not supposed to hate because you could hurt somebody or something like that. But then he says, but if it's not admitted, it can quickly and easily metamorphose into the evil that provokes it. Mm. So if you don't express your own hatred, what can happen is that it becomes the very evil that it can transform into the very evil that sort of occasioned it. I think about in another place, Brueggemann talks about he kind of envisions God as like the therapist, where you have to go and be able to say all of this so that you don't actually murder the babies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Hmm. Because if you try to pretend it's not there, it doesn't just go away. There's no actually like getting rid of it. You have to be able to express it.
Right.
And then he says, just a couple more sentences here. He says, it doesn't mean that prayer legitimizes hate. It's not saying hate is like good. He says, it doesn't legitimize it. It utilizes it. Human hate is not a very promising first step to the establishment of righteousness. But until we are in prayer, we are not teachable. It is better to, and he says, pray badly. It's better to pray badly than to not pray at all. A ship that is dead in the water can't be steered. And that's like the Spock thing, right? Like, just kind of like, no, I don't feel this. Well, then God can't do anything with that. So we need to be able to pray what is, and without worrying about whether that's right or wrong or whether it's good or bad, because when we're open and acknowledging that, then we become teachable about the longer road that is whatever we should do with it, you know, whatever the actual holy response is. We can, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And when we loop in God on anything that is frustrating us on a minor level to, you know, something brutal, we're redirecting our energy away from our fellow human, which I think is something helpful about Ephesians 6, right? We're not battling against flesh and blood, because then it helps you remember, oh, right, that politician that I hate isn't it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That shouldn't be what I'm mad at. And when we loop in God and express, like, how come this person hasn't experienced whatever you want them to experience, then you're bringing God in and you're directing some of that rage toward them rather than toward yourself, your family, or others, right? And God is someone who can handle that. And the conversation then becomes a continual dialogue between you and God, which there is room for the Spirit to work in, rather than that expression of hate, right? From a neurological standpoint, when we're experiencing hate, it's releasing adrenaline, and adrenaline is like glue that keeps a memory in our brain, right? When you think back, memories that stay with you are ones where like your heart rate was accelerated and et cetera. But when we don't do the work, some folks say, of processing, of bringing it to God, of working through it in community, not just alone, right? We sat together, we wept together. Then those pathways in our brain just get reinforced over and over. And we think like, oh, catharsis, I'll just like get it out there. The more we rehearse our hate, the more it gets encoded in our brain, the harder it is to have neuroplasticity. And so figuring out an outlet that doesn't just encode that path, right? Going back to Marty's teaching again, which I'm sure Brent can put in the show notes. He talks about how your forgiveness is not complete until the black cloud that surrounds that other person for you doesn't accompany them. Whenever you think of that person, you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
person in my family, that politician, that person in my workplace or my class or whatever. Until that cloud is gone, it's not finished yet. Our forgiveness isn't finished. Our healing isn't finished. So I love that. I love that redirect to God in prayer and giving space for the Spirit. And not trying to be performative to God in prayer, right? Because if you just wait until you're holy enough, you won't be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a question down here that was, how do we articulate our hatred without being completely consumed by it? But I think we kind of just answered that, you know, like that in prayer, in unfiltered, not concerned with what ought to be, but where it is, like that is a way that we can articulate it, that we can express it without being consumed by it.
But taking that seriously, right? The beast does crouch by the door and its desire is to rule over you. Not forgetting that you're in danger every time you're experiencing anger, like... there's things that can ruin your life. Anger is one of them.
So that leads to my last question here, which is for anybody who is maybe then ready to take the next step down the road, right? From like, if you're wanting to move from happy is the one who will take your babies and throw them against the rocks, you're wanting to move from that posture to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. I realize this is a big question, but like, is there one thing that either of you would say to somebody who is like, okay, I've been praying out this like hatred that I'm experiencing, and now I'm like wanting to like move towards the longer, sustainable, holier road of being Jesus-like here with this person? What do I do?
First, no.
Okay.
Yes. The first no is because just like giving blanket advice to people in infinitely complex situations is a infinitely dangerous thing, right? I'm speaking from my experience and people that I've been in relationship and my understanding of scripture, but I don't know, listener out there, what kind of situation you're in, if you're still in danger, if you're not still in danger, exactly what, like, I don't know. And so I think it behooves all of us to give that space, that like saying, well, the Bema teaching team said that I should blah, 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 like take some time, be in community, see what applies and what doesn't apply. You have the Spirit within you. Please, please talk to the Spirit about, you know, everything. So just acknowledging that first, no. But secondly, one thing that's been helpful for me and helpful for other people, I think all the time about 2 Corinthians chapter 1. What, Brent?
It's 2 Corinthians. That's the core of our scripture right there.
2 Corinthians chapter 1 talks about, it doesn't actually talk about the suffering that much that Paul and gang have been experiencing, but he says that he is able to experience gratitude because now the comfort that he has experienced from that, he can use to comfort others. So why do I think about that? Because I think gratitude is a healing pathway. And gratitude is something that is offensive and, in fact, can be very dangerous, again, when slapped across the face of people who have survived anything. But there is something radical for those who are able to receive it, the place in their journey that they are, to say, well, who am I now? What kind of work am I doing now? Hopefully, there's something about who God has made you to be that you feel positive about, the ability to say, look, what my dad did or the way that this was handled in my life was truly brutal. And yet the person I am today has a keen eye toward other people who are suffering and wants to help. Or, that can look a million different ways with everybody's vocations and their relationships. Or because I went through that divorce, I was able to help my friend who was in an abusive marriage, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the space for gratitude is not at all pointed toward the perpetrator. Never. Nothing to do with the perpetrator, right? Joseph doesn't say, thank you, brothers, for like wanting to kill me and throwing me in a pit. Like, you guys are great. He didn't say that. He said, what you meant for evil, God used for good. And so there's this gratitude component of, well, if I have any appreciation for the work that I'm able to do in the world through God, the fact that this happened to me is an important component to that, because everything that happened in our lives, right, shape us for who we are today. So being grateful for who we are now and the space that we found now and the wisdom that we found now and the work that we're able to engage in now helps remove at least pieces of that hate, to say, well, if I had been raised a different way, then I wouldn't be me. And I've seen God be incredibly faithful to me in enabling me to XYZ. So that's a path that I know of.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm sure other people have other things, but that's what comes to mind for me.
Mm. Brent, is there anything for you that you have found helpful in moving along that path?
No, I think I'm actually quite terrible at this. Mm. This has been a very self-reflective episode for me, which is why I have not said much.
Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I think for me, I think a recognition, and this is something, I think you're absolutely right, L, to point out that like blanket advice is dangerous. And so I'm not wanting to give that, and to recognize that, you know, the particular situation and the amount of time that somebody has actually been given so far to deal with whatever has had, like that's going to be different and that matters. And like for me on this kind of path for a long time now, and recognizing that, you know, again, the particulars of my own situation, but what's helpful for me has been, I think God giving the courage to keep asking questions about like my perpetrators. I think I know the whole story about the who and the why, and it's very difficult to like be willing to open up to asking, maybe I don't know all of the who and the why.
Yeah.
But as I do, there's something that is potentially humanizing about that for them. And I think it's that like curiosity, that please God, we need courage and strength to like have the curiosity, but it's the curiosity that enables for, I have seen the anger to be sort of like transmuted into something more like compassion. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get changed into any like excusing, right? Or approval or anything like that.
Right.
But into compassion. And then Jesus, like when Jesus is moved with compassion, he works to rescue and save. And, that's, you know, again, we don't have to go into all of the like caveats
Jesus
and nuances
stuff
and everything. Right.
No,
right.
That's what, but too much,
yeah, for
Jesus.
Me, that's for me, that's what's been helpful. Yeah, I think this is a good place to wrap it up, because I don't want to, I mean, this psalm is about giving that space,
yeah,
for us to
not having,
you know,
a bow
and
on
I don't want to undo that by being like, and now here's what, you know, but I was just thinking, if there are people who are like, okay, yeah, I've been there, but I think I want to like, I want to entertain the idea of moving along. What is something that can be done? So I wanted to end with something along those lines, but I don't want to like put too neat of a package on it all. So I think we can kind of let it lie there.
I mean, I think Jesus had the expansiveness of spirit to be able to say, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Mm-hmm. And so I think leaving people at least with, may we all be people looking like our Lord, who have the expansiveness of spirit to be able to leave the justice to God and not try to do it of our own accord, right? Because mm-hmm. He's the one reaping out that throwing people on crags, not us.
Right.
And then also to be able to let them go and even, like Jesus, advocate for them, which is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that'll do it. So yeah, all of those things will be at BayMontesEpiscopal.com in the show notes, as well as in your app or whatever. Check out some of those resources if you haven't already from the earlier episodes. A lot of these psalms are very, very difficult and challenging to consider, or maybe necessary to wrestle through if you're coming from a perspective of abuse or whatever, where you need to process these things. And that stuff's not very fun to do alone. So be in community if you're not already, or go to therapy if you haven't done that. Like, get the help that you need to process through this stuff. So heavy episode for me. I imagine it will be for a number of people. So thank you for joining us in this moment, in this space, in this discussion. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Over the sparkling rivers poured together. There we sat and also wept when we remembered Zion. So I'm supposed to pronounce that with your alternative transliteration.
Is that a tsade?
It is a tsade. So it should really be Zion. But Zion. You can go with a Zion. That's fine. Okay. That's what people are used to.
I don't know what's going on.
You know, it's really hard for Anglo speakers to get other
it is.
Okay, we're gonna restart this and we're gonna get on track.
We're not gonna do that.
No. Let's just restart. I wanna read the psalm all the way through without stopping because I wanna just get
without
the whole thing.
Sass.
Without the sass.
Okay.
Although I was thankful for the opportunity to show off my new Hebrew knowledge.
That was pretty good.
Of a letter. So thank you.
I'm proud of you. Yeah.
Gold star for me. Okay, Brent, let's go top to bottom.
All right, I'm gonna read it. I'm going to read it as Zion, and then we can discuss it at the end of the reading.
I don't care. We don't need to discuss it.
Well, I'd like to discuss it, and I'd like to give Reed a chance to show off his knowledge. I was making the same assumption that Reed stated out loud, and so he gets credit for it.
We're going
to
get through this, you guys.
Now, I'm not supposed to read the whole thing, right? I'm just reading this chunk.
Sorry. No, I didn't do as good a job with the format of the doc. Read the whole thing, so all the highlighted red.
Everything that's red.
Everything that's red. Okay. Read it all the way through.
Pink
red.
It's light red 3.
Wow. We are just all being insufferable today. Yeah. I feel like we just need to start this episode over.
No, this will be an easy splice for when
Time
I start
to break
reading.
For okay. lunch.